You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
wir werden herausfinden.
We will find out exactly what was behind the act in Munich. We will not rest until we know exactly how the Würzburg perpetrator has radicalized himself.
As Germany experiences a spate of violent incidents ranging from mass shootings to a suicide bombing in one weekend, we'll ask why the nation is suddenly under attack. My guests, Kathleen Burke and Matthew Green, will be discussing this and the other day's top stories, including the latest developments in Turkey and why the Democratic Party in the USA is in turmoil.
I told you long time ago that the DNC was not running a fair operation, that they were supporting Secretary Clinton. So what I suggested to be true 6 months ago turns out, in fact, to be true. I'm not shocked, but I am disappointed.
Bernie Sanders there. All that, plus why Barack Obama's half-brother is choosing to vote Trump. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL, and Matthew Green, former FT correspondent in West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Well, welcome both to the programme. But we're going to start today in Germany, which has suffered a spate of violent attacks in the past week, forcing many in the country to question why us and why now. The violence began early last week with an axe and knife attack on a German train. And this was followed by the horrific mass shooting in Munich on Friday, which killed 9 people. The weekend then saw a suicide bombing in Ansbach, and that which killed only the attacker, and also a machete killing in Reutlingen. It makes for a grim Monday's reading, and Germans are beginning to ask questions about what kind of society they want to live in. Matthew, why do we think there has been this sudden spate of attacks in Germany?
Well, what's interesting is that actually there doesn't seem to be much of a common thread running through them, does there? You've got this machete attack, which by all accounts was by a Syrian asylum seeker who was in love with his colleague who he murdered. You've got the shooting by a teenager in Munich who apparently was bullied and suffered from psychiatric problems. And then the axe attack, which has been claimed by Islamic State, and then this suicide bombing. So there's all kinds of factors at play, asylum seekers, suggestions of links to terrorist groups in some of them, but by no means all of them.
And do you wonder, you know, that you know we fall into a trap here always of trying to find a narrative between rather different incidents. And as you say, here we have maybe, you know, a disaffected youth who we know was following Anders Breivik's attacks in Norway 5 years ago, who acted on the anniversary of that. You know, and although he had a part Iranian background, you know, he's not part of any kind of terrorist movement. In fact, you know, lots of people have spoken out against people who jumped to that conclusion on Friday. So in a way, there is some calm needed here before we try and join up too many of these incidents.
Exactly, because there is really that danger, isn't there, that the atmosphere created by this spate of attacks really amplifies any single incident, and it's very easy for that fear to have a ripple effect, and then the backlash, of course, begins, and we see the prejudice coming out against refugees and asylum seekers, and the kind of divisions that have obviously started to gape wider and wider in neighbouring France, and it will be tragic if Germany, which has played such a leading role in welcoming a million refugees with open arms, would suddenly start to find itself falling deeper and deeper into that kind of nationalist backlash that we've seen signs of, but obviously could always get a lot worse.
Kathleen, this is important, isn't it, for Angela Merkel? Even if these incidents are not connected, she needs to be controlling, not controlling in the sense of telling them what to think, but she needs to get hold of this story to make sure that, as you know, Matthew says, it doesn't run away and become just a migrant story. She needs to make sure that the broader story of what's been happening and what these incidents are about actually gets across.
course, it depends what you mean by the wider story. If you think about it, one thing it ties together a lot of the difficulties, I mean, France, as well as partly in Germany, is a question of employment. That you have an awful lot of young men who don't have an awful lot to do right now. And it brings into question, I think, the unity of German society in the sense that people don't quite realize that Germany itself is more unequal than most other wealthy Western societies. And it's very difficult to move in the society. You, for various institutional reasons, you tend to be staying what staying where you are, in a sense. And if you have an economy and a society that is reasonably unmovable, and then all of a sudden you've got a million more people in a year, that's going to produce tensions that are there and aren't very encouraging. Now, I agree with Matthew. What's the link between a 17-year-old German-Iranian teenager and a 17-year-old Afghan teenager and the general sort of attacks? And obviously, part of them are driven by jihadists. But it seems to me that there are a significant number that are driven by personal reasons, by the situation each individual is finding himself in. And I think that's what's going to be difficult. I mean, they want Mom America, obviously, to draw everyone together and reassure everyone. But Germany is, in many respects, at a turning point right now, and it's not clear to me in which direction it's going to turn.
But doesn't that make it, as Matthew says, rather complicated? Because, in a way, it would be so much easier if this was four youths who felt alienated from society, who hadn't been, something hadn't been done for them. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It means that the response to this, Kathleen, is difficult to gauge because you don't know where to begin. As you said, one's just probably a slightly crazed kid sitting in his bedroom who makes a plot. There's no way of finding him. There's very little that the central government could have done. Yes, maybe the school should have been better. Yes, maybe the education authorities should have spotted something. But for central government, there's not much that Angela Merkel can do in a policy sense, is there?
No, there isn't. In a sense, one needs, I suppose, more resources given to intelligence situation. The lender, of course, are much more independent than various sections of other states. They're much more independent than the different sections are in France, for example. And what I don't know, it'd be interesting to find out, is to the extent that local intelligence resources are being devoted to this, or do they even have them? Are they entirely controlled by central government? That's one reason that Britain has done, please God, and I better touch wood, relatively well, is that the quality of the local intelligence is much higher than in most other countries, for whatever bad or good reason we want to think about it. But no, I mean, all you can do is look, hope, and hope that local politicians can produce situations, whether it's more help for the asylum seekers, whether it's criminy. What can they do? I agree with you entirely, Andrew, that at this point people are spinning around on their feet in Germany.
But that spinning, Matthew, that's the other interesting thing I think we need to touch on, because what is interesting is when you do speak to Germans in Germany, there is, it just is the same as in Paris or in Brussels or in London when there have been attacks. You end up with this slight feeling of unease. People don't know what should be done or what lies around the corner. We had a report actually just before that attack on Friday. We had a story here which was saying 60-odd% of Germans felt that it was like there would be a terrorist attack at some point in the coming weeks. So if people are walking around with that sense of unease, even if Merkel can't do much, there is a feeling that there are some things going on in German society that are just leaving people feeling a bit unsure.
Yeah, and it ripples well beyond Germany, doesn't it? We talked for a moment about what had happened in France, but even in the UK, I think people are more nervous. Just looking at some of the comments you see on social media now about migrants and refugees in the light of these attacks, I think reflects a growing fear that something similar will happen here, whether rightly or wrongly. So, and you see these concerns playing into the tone of the presidential campaign in the US as well. So it's incredible, really, how these individuals acting in isolated capacity or otherwise can have such an incredible impact globally, even with some of these attacks carried out with axes and machetes.
And Kathleen, the interesting thing, other thing, you know, as we said, the numbers is 1 million people potentially that have crossed the borders into Germany, into Austria. We were there on a work trip as that happened last summer. And, you know, we were in Munich train station as people. We were on a train that we didn't realise we jumped on the last minute that was full of people making that journey. And when you got off at Munich train station, there was, you know, like 200-300 people got off who the German authorities were very quick at kind of, you know, in a nice way, corralling off, saying, are you on the move? Are you migrants? And they had a kind of a health check centre and things. But when I looked at that queue of people, there was some interesting things. Nearly all unaccompanied young men, all roughly 17, 18, 19, 20. Many, by the look of it, were, you know, Tajiks, Uzbeks, not just, you know, people coming from Syria. And so for German society, this notion of, you know, that you have a responsibility for inclusiveness, that's a hard bet. First of all, you've got to find out who all these people are. Most of them don't speak German, so they need language skills as well as employment skills. You know, to either of you, in a way, are we hoping for too much? Because, you know, in past big migration moves, you know, people coming to the UK in the 40s, the 50s, 30s, whatever, we felt it was a generational jump, you know, that you would have, you know, 15, 20 years for you to make that leap. And now Merkel has set herself an impossible task of trying to get all of these people into employment, learning German, part of society, without their families with them, hanging out with each other. Isn't that just too big a ask? You know, in a way, does Merkel have some responsibility here? I mean, as, you know, moving aside from that, some of these attacks do not fall into this category. Does she have some responsibility to say, I've kind of taken on something here actually that is a little bit beyond our ability to work with?
Not when she's got an election coming up next year. That's the problem, and her political party under some danger, especially from the AfD, you know, from the right, the party from the right, you know, right wing of Germany.
But did she just press on and say it's all going to be fine?
Well, she can't say that. She can say that we are doing what we can, and things are getting better, and certainly in parts of the country it's much better. I mean, one problem with Bavaria is that so many of them are there. That was the first stop, is, you know, coming up in many respects. And areas in north, northwest Germany, some of the central parts, you know, there are German classes, there's a lot. They're coping, but of course they're coping, I suppose, from the other side, is because they're not so large a proportion of the population. But yes, it's the unaccompanying young men that are the danger, and that's quite clear. That's quite clear. That's my, hence back to my original point about employment.
We should move on, because there's an interesting, slightly connected story here, I guess, Matthew, which is, you know, the Turkey story. Turkey has become this kind of cork in the bottle, as it were, stopping the migration coming up through Turkey, up through the Balkans. But we've now had this coup in Turkey, this failed coup. Just today we've seen 40-odd journalists arrested. And, you know, the EU is beginning to say, look, they're not going to be a member for any time soon, maybe for a very long time. Isn't this just the point, again, for a moment of honesty, to say Turkey will not be a member of the EU and does not deserve to be a member of the EU?
Well, it was Jean-Claude Juncker, wasn't it, who made these comments, yeah, saying that Turkey's probably not going to join anytime soon, which does seem pretty obvious at this point. I mean, I think it's just incredible the scale of what's happening in Turkey at the moment. Tens of thousands of people being rounded up after this incredibly dramatic failed coup attempt. It's been compared to a kind of restructuring of the state on the scale of the Cultural Revolution in China, by some commentators. I mean, this is a potentially huge shift in the internal dynamics in Turkey. And I think the idea of them joining the EU is gone far out of the window now. And the question is whether the Turkish state itself will be able to weather the pressure that it's now under. All these university deans who've been removed, the thousands of judges who've been purged, teachers, members of the state-run airline, and these 42 journalists who are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's extraordinary what's going on.
Extraordinary, Kathleen. But why won't they just say, we don't want you. We don't want you to be a member of the EU. You do not live up to the standards that we have set. Because they keep on holding out for all of these countries this kind of like temptation because they fear that they're going to fall into, you know, some kind of Russian orbit, or they're going to be kind of lost to Europe in some sense. But sometimes, don't you have to just say, look, I'm sorry, it doesn't seem you will ever meet these criteria. We need to stop this process for now.
Well, Juncker has just said it. It's been said. It doesn't.
Well,
he says
for a very, very long time.
Well, he said not for a long time. Yes, it's not necessarily going to be forever. You know, until the sun goes into explosive mode. I mean, there are other things to worry about. And I mean, for one thing, Turkey is in NATO now. Matthew didn't mention it quite so much, but the hollowing out of the Turkish military forces is quite scary. One reason that Turkey has been let off lightly is because of the agreement Merkel made to stop all the refugees coming from Turkey through Greece. Well, that's dying down because the word has gotten around that the path through the Balkans is closed. And so the leverage he has for that argument, I think, is quite clearly lessening. So he can't threaten Europe directly in a way that he could before, 3-6 months ago. So in that sense, he's not as powerful as he was. What has come over Turkey as well, of course, is, I understand, very widespread, is now a profound anti-Americanism. Everyone seems to be convinced that the U.S. was behind the coup. I can't think myself as anything rather more stupid at this point. What the U.S. would not want is a destabilized Turkey. They really wouldn't want a destabilized Turkey. And they don't want an Ilich air base, which they have been using as the jump-off point for bombing ISIS. They don't want that closed down, which is what happened, you know, after the coup for a while. So it doesn't benefit the United States at all.
But it's amazing, isn't it, how in some countries this anti-American narrative can take over like wildfire. I mean, working in Pakistan, for example, the number of conspiracy theories that you would hear on a daily basis was extraordinary. The problem, of course, was there was always a grain of truth, and America did do enough nefarious things to justify some of the suspicion, but certainly not all of it. I remember in Afghanistan talking to elders from Kandahar who were convinced that the reason that the US hadn't defeated the Taliban was because it was in league with the Taliban and supplying them with weapons in helicopters landing in the distant mountains. So I'm just kind of picking up on your point about this sort of anti-American sentiment. It's quite remarkable how virulent and persuasive it can be, even in the face of all rational refutation.
If one wants to be quite cynical about this, if Trump becomes president and is making such a big point of pulling back from all this, who are they going to blame?
Well, they'll still blame America, I'm afraid. But the interesting thing for Erdogan, I guess, the card he's got up his sleeve now always is to say, well, I said there was, you know, a state within the state. I said, you know, Fethullah Gulen was going to attempt a coup. And nobody has believed it all this time. And they thought he was using that as a way of, you know, already controlling all sorts of institutions such as journalism. But then they've gone and proved him right. So whatever he says now for his followers, they will believe him, don't you think, Kathleen?
Well, the problem is, I mean, there have been four previous coups. None of them were linked with Gulen. I mean, probably the Turkish military forces, who are convinced that they are the support of the Ataturk secular state, probably don't really need Gulen. Who knows? I don't know if all these 60,000 were actually sleeper cells of Gulen supporters. I don't know. But it's there's no doubt that it's extremely convenient. It's also that Erdogan and his office have said, yes, we had these lists already ready. So it's not a question that they're going after those who they are, you know, who took part in the coup. They're going after those they wanted to go after anyhow. And as Erdogan himself said, it's a God-given opportunity to cleanse the state. So it's a shame. I like Turkey a lot. And it's a shame to see it in such turmoil and to have appalling suspicions of what it's going to come out as. And one doesn't hope, but I mean, one hopes. But I think Turkey for the next 10 or 15 years is going to be difficult as an ally and difficult the question of whether it's going to be an island, you know, an actual rock of stability at that end of the Middle East. I just don't know. Well, nor does anyone, for that matter.
I'm sure we'll be able to supply a few answers in the coming weeks here on Midori House. You're listening to Midori House Indeed with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and Matthew Green. Coming up next, we'll be looking at the Democrat Party's National Convention in Philadelphia.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Matthew Green. The US Democrat Party's National Convention begins today in Philadelphia. And one of the speakers appearing on its opening night is not best pleased. Bernie Sanders will take to the stage this evening, and he does so after a chaotic weekend for the party. Its chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was forced to resign after being implicated in leaked emails that suggest she favoured Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders during the closely fought leadership campaign. Hillary has now secured the nomination, of course, but is Bernie still going to cause her problems? Matthew, do you think he is?
Well, it's really up to him now, isn't it, to come out and say, you're either with me and Hillary or you're with Trump.
Well, it looked a bit like Erdogan. He said, I told you so all along. I knew there was a plot in the background, and now I've been proved right.
Yeah, and he's justified in feeling aggrieved, isn't he? And the evidence of these emails is pretty damning against the leadership of the Democratic Party. But look at the alternative. Where does Western civilization end up in come November if Donald Trump is in the White House? I mean, you know, however aggrieved he is, let's just hope he buries the hatchet and does his best to rally behind Hillary.
Do you think Bernie will be good for the cause?
Yes, I think he will. He's a highly intelligent man. He's made his point publicly. Everyone has made his point for him. He doesn't need to make the point again tonight. And since he already said the most important thing is that Trump be defeated, I suspect he's not going to go and do a Ted Cruz. You know, he's not going to try to undermine Hillary Clinton. Because if he does, of course, and she loses, he will carry the can in many respects, in many people's eyes. So I think, in fact, he's going to be treated extremely well tonight because they will hope that he actually does what everyone hopes he will do at that convention. I suspect he will.
Matthew, lots going on to try and humanize Hillary, try and tell her backstory, try and make her, you know, somebody the electorate really understands, especially women voters who have been oddly not willing to get behind her in many instances. What is the sticking point with Hillary? And do you think that the Trump side have actually been rather effective at kind of, you know, blaming her for all sorts of things that will kind of stick in more moderate minds as well?
Well, there is a paradox, isn't there? Because she's obviously one of the best known, perhaps the best known candidates ever to stand as US president.
But at a time when we don't trust politicians, so that's a problem.
That's true. And the question, I suppose, is what is she actually standing for? Has she been able to put together a coherent message that is very simple and resonates with voters? I mean, Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again, whatever you think about the candidate, is arguably a much more compelling slogan than Stronger Together, I think. It just has a better ring to it. And I think that's perhaps symptomatic of a broader problem in the Democrat camp of saying, well, we've got all these policy proposals. We know that Clinton has a wonderful command of the details. She has a formidable intellect. But how do you mold that into something that's really going to resonate with the undecideds?
What do you feel, Kathleen? Do you feel that she could use this convention to finally begin to be? Yeah, now she's, all the battles are done. She's got herself to where she wanted to be. Does she have a chance now to just hit Trump and actually for Democratic voters begin to show why she should be elected?
Well, remember the impact her speech. On foreign policy against Trump, how widely praised that was. She does, she has the ability. She doesn't have to go so much for the progressive left because Elizabeth Warren's going to be giving a talk. A speech, and she's a brilliant orator. Her vice presidential candidate, who again is a brilliant choice, will take care of that solid part, and that leaves her to fly on rhetoric. Now, our question is, will she fly on rhetoric? I suspect that enough people have said she's got to make an impact. I mean, anyone who lectures regularly, like me, for example, it seems to me that four main points are all that people can really pick up. If someone tells her that and holds her to it, I don't see the problem. She'll be coming there as though it's Miss America who's already won. All attention finally will be focused on her. She's been creaming for this for a long time, so. I know we're supposed to be neutral, but after seeing...
We're definitely not neutral in this one.
I'm not neutral. Monocle 24 is going to surprise everyone. We don't want to see a Trump presidency.
Oh, well, all right. I was doing my best here for academic impartiality. But since I can throw myself into it, obviously, I hope to God that Clinton wins. Will that do it?
Amen. No, we do. Now, but there's one vote that we already know has definitely been secured by Donald Trump. And that, bizarrely, is the vote of Barack Obama's half-brother, Malik, who used to live in Maryland, back in Kenya currently. Apparently he was the best man at the wedding or something. But anyway, he said he's going to vote for Trump. It comes in a kind of line of, slightly dodgy relatives for presidents. Bill Clinton's half-brother, Roger, was sent to prison in 1985 for cocaine dealing. Jimmy Carter's brother, Billy, was an alcoholic gas station owner. That doesn't sound so bad, does it? But Al Gore's son, he was arrested for doing 100 miles in a Prius. That doesn't seem such a bad thing. I think it's well done for getting 100 miles an hour, Prius, personally. But anyway, the media love them, but do they stick these stories? Do they have any implication? Do you feel sorry for any of these politicians, Matthew?
I have to admit, I did feel a little bit sorry for President Obama when this half-brother crawled out of the woodwork and said, well, I'm voting for Trump. And Trump immediately delightfully tweeted his remarks. And I mean, this is Malik Obama, who's obviously older from a previous marriage. Is a sort of small-time politician in southwestern Kenya who feels aggrieved that Obama didn't come out batting for him in his bid for local office and decides to sort of hold court and talk about how his half-brothers let him down and provide some fodder for the Trump campaign. And I don't think any of us are particularly pleased that he's seen fit to run his mouth off like that and, sees a bit of media attention at his brother's expense and maybe the expense of all of the rest of us come November. You read off some examples from the States there, but you don't have to look much further around the world to see much more egregious examples of kind of family dynasties. I'm thinking back to Pakistan and obviously Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, then President Zardari, her husband, and now Bilawal, Bhutto, her son, who may be, who is a politician and maybe a future leader in Pakistan.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave, Kathleen, because I was going to ask you your view on kind of urinating half-brothers. That was back to Jimmy Carter's brother. He did apparently in front of the whole press corps on the tarmac. But we are going to have to leave that show there. I think Kathleen's probably rather delighted, actually. But my thanks to Kathleen Burke and also to Matthew Green. That's all we have time for on today's show, which was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and by Patrick Hahn and also by Jakob Lederne. And our studio manager was Christopher Grimes. There's more music next than 1900 Hours. It's Culture with Robert Bound, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for now, goodbye.